Thank you. I have have to scoot up and start very quickly because time is very limited. The previous occasion on which I had the honour to address this group was as a substitute for Lord Hapgood, so I'm very delighted this evening to be on the same bill, so to speak. I have in my hand a piece of paper. This is actually the draft report of the Infection Surveillance Steering Group of Uxara, the group which Lord Hapgood chairs. And I wanted just to start by quoting from it. It is only a discussion document, but it outlines conditions that it, at this stage, believes xenotransplant recipients would have to agree to if they were to receive a transplant. And I'll just mention four of them. They have to agree to use barrier contraception consistently and for life. They have to agree to refrain from pregnancy or fathering a child, to allow the relevant health authorities to be notified when moving abroad, and to be willing to identify possible contacts beyond known close contacts in case of adverse events. Now, this is probably what the previous speaker referred to as continued vigilance. Now, for me, these sorts of conditions raise a problem about how to approach safety. Because if and for so long as it might be felt that safety required these sorts of conditions to be imposed on recipients, and given that these conditions could not conceivably be imposed on, I mean, you can tell them, but how do you stop, how do you ensure that somebody uses contraception for life and never fathers a child? So if safety requires these conditions, and given that they could not conceivably be imposed or policed, then it seems to me that there is a continuing safety problem. The second safety problem, which I think hasn't been given enough attention, is the public reaction problem. Even if this work is successful and we become assured that there's no danger of communication to the public, it's unclear to me that we won't have the same irrational, as I see it, reaction that we've had to GM crops. And if we do, this would make it virtually impossible in the real world to introduce xenotransplantation. Now, I say that with no pleasure, because I would like very much for xenotransplantation to be successful. It seems to me that the only significant ethical problem of xenotransplantation, this is why in a moment I'm going to move on to a slightly different issue, is animal welfare. And while that can be protected, it's inconceivable to me that there would be other moral objections from a carnivorous society. There is an issue about using primates, and it is, I think, disturbing to many that 300 primates have been used in this program. But if there was a real and present prospect of xenotransplantation being successful, I would imagine that that would be justifiable. However, and this is what I want to turn to the main part of my presentation, we have a huge interim ethical problem, if I may put it that way. We have an ethical problem about what to do pending the development of either successful xenotransplantation or what I think is more likely to be successful on no grounds but a hunch, and that is the use of cloned human ES cells to develop tailor-made organs. But pending the development of those two technologies, we have a huge interim problem, which I think is acute. And I want to go on to say something about that problem and to suggest two radical interim solutions that we could use. Just a quick bit of background to the problem. Some time ago, Archbishop Trevor Huddleston, writing in the Journal of the British Kidney Patients Association, quoted the transplant advisor of Papworth Hospital as suggesting that in the case of heart transplants, around 25% of people on the waiting list died before a transplant became available. I don't know how that would translate to total organ transplants for the UK. But things are getting worse. Recent figures issued by the Royal College of Surgeons indicate that there are currently less than half the number of registered donors needed to meet the demand, and that 30% of relatives of people who have died refuse to give permission for their organs to be removed. But even these disturbing figures need to be placed in a global context. The waiting lists in international terms represent a major catastrophe on a global scale. There are around 100,000 people currently needing kidney transplants in India. About 3,000 transplants are performed in India annually. So that will give you an approximate death rate. And almost all of the 3,000 transplants that are performed in India are from live, unrelated female donors. Now, there is a lesson in those figures which is disturbing in itself. Around 61,000 are waiting for transplants in the US, of which 40,000 are waiting for kidneys. In Italy, there are about 30,000 people on dialysis. In the United States, for the latest year that I have accurate figures for, in 1997, 20,000 transplants were performed. And the most recent death figures that I have from the United States in 1996 show that of the 72,000 patients then on the waiting list, 4,022 died while waiting for kidneys. So I see the ethical task as addressing the issue of how we can stem this global tragedy on a massive scale. How can we stem this loss of life while we are waiting for a relatively cheap, hopefully, depending on how Novartis priced their product, but a relatively ceap answer from xenotransplantation or a probably rather more expensive, certainly in R&D costs, answer from cloned human stem cells. I want to ask what a decent public policy on donation would be. And I'm going to suggest two things that I think would be part of a decent immediate public policy. And I shall take the philosopher's liberty of fantasizing in a rather unreasonable way, since I alluded in the case of xenotransplantations to public reaction. I shall assume that the force of what I have to say will carry the public with me instantly. Of course, if it didn't, then it would be impossible, if not unethical, in a democracy to try to implement the measures that I shall suggest. At the moment, as you know, we have an opting in system, donor cards, and there's been some pressure to move, and I think there's a growing groundswell now to move to a system of opting out, which is sometimes called presumed consent. Now, I myself am worried by presumed consent. I wouldn't say this in the media, but I think presumed consent is no consent at all. If it matters that people consent to what happens to them, then you must get a consent. Presumed consent is a fiction. And while it is a useful fiction, and while given the huge death toll that I've referred to might justify the use of such a fiction, it is a fiction nonetheless. You saw me turning pages. I'm leaving out the argument as to why, for the sake of time, presumed consent doesn't work. There is some detailed argument there, and if anybody would like me to send them a copy of this paper, I would be happy to do so. But in the end, I agree with the English philosopher Jeremy Bentham, who was rightly scathing of fiction in the English context. And I just want to read you what he said. In English law, fiction is a syphilis, which runs in every vein and carries into every part of the system the principle of rottenness. Fiction of use to justice, exactly as swindling is to trade. It affords presumptive and conclusive evidence of moral turpitude in those by whom it was invented and first employed. Pleased to say that 19th century philosophers were far more robust than their more timid 20th century counterparts. So what do I recommend? Two policies, and I want to indicate what they are very quickly. First, it seems to me iniquitous, genuinely iniquitous, that all the moral concern of our society has so far been focused on the dead, who by and large don't need it, and on their friends and relatives. But there are two separate sets of individuals who have moral claims on us, not just one. There is the deceased individual for cadaver donations and his or her family and friends, and there is the potential organ or tissue recipient and her family and friends. Both have claims upon us. Neither's claim has obvious priority. If we weigh the damage to the sensibilities of the relatives of cadaver donors, if their wishes are overridden, against the damage done to would-be recipients, if they fail to get the organs that they need, where should the balance of our moral concern lie? It seems to me that if we address the question, who stands to lose most, which I think is a very useful question always to ask in moral contexts, there are rival groups of claimants on our attention, and one group stands to lose more than the other if they don't get our attention. That's a very good reason for prioritizing that group. And for that sort of reason, I would say we should, ideally, if we could carry the public with us, dispense with opting out and move straight to a system of automatic availability of cadaver organs for donation. Just make them automatically available. And I will offer you one precedent for such a policy, which seems to me to be obvious but is never taken up, and that is the precedent of post-mortem examinations. About 90%, I'm informed, of the post-mortems done in this country, many of you will be better informed than I, are court or coroner-ordered post-mortems. You can't contract out. You can't conscientiously object. Your body is cut up, and as we know from some celebrated cases recently, not all of it is put back. Indeed, all of it could not conceivably be put back because the biopsied samples remain outside. Why is that done? Well, it's done in the public interest. Possibly, if we suspect foul play, to make sure that a murderer is not at large and more people will not be killed by that murderer, and possibly because there is an undetected disease or cause of accidents at large that we wish to discover. So we justify that in the public interest in order to save the lives of citizens at risk. I would like to suggest that we have precisely the same justifications to make cadaver organs available for transplant. There's a powerful public interest, and that public interest has to be understood in terms of the lives that will be saved, the lives that will be protected, just as in the justification for post-mortem examinations. Seems to me we have a precedent, we accept that. If it was put in the right way, I could not see why that should not be acceptable as an appropriate policy for cadaver transplants. And if it were, then there's good evidence that we might make good the shortfall and even be able to export some organs from Britain to other needy places. In the last few minutes available, I want to turn to an even more controversial suggestion. I want to describe to you a possible ethical market for live human donations or live human transplants. Many organ transplants are live, and there is good evidence that they are better in the sense that the prognosis is better if you're the recipient of a live transplant than a cadaver transplant. So there is some clinical reason to prefer live transplants. But everybody throws up their hands in horror at the possibilities for exploitation and other iniquities that might flow on permitting the sale of organs. So in a minute and a half that I have left, I want to describe to you a possible ethical market. And my challenge is, for the discussion period, show me why it wouldn't be ethical. The market would have to meet these conditions. Firstly, it would be what I've called a monopsonistic market, a market with one purchaser, possibly like the National Health Service, that would purchase organs centrally and distribute them according to medical need, not in accordance with ability to pay. Secondly, the market would have to be confined to something like a nation state or a geopolitical quasi-self-governing area, possibly like the European Union. The point of that would be that anybody and their family who sold an organ into the marketplace would be eligible to receive, on the benefit of need, on the basis of need, organs in their turn. So there would be no going to Bombay or to Turkey, buying organs from the poor, selling them to the rich in Harley Street, and those people who've donated organs and their families would never stand a chance of benefiting if they, in their turn, needed organs. So it would be confined to a system that could manage that and could manage the screening of organs, the provenance collecting, and all of that. But I think if those conditions were met, then it would be reasonable to pay people for live donations. Reasonable because we deceive ourselves if we think we have an altruistic system at the moment. What we have at the moment is a system where everybody but the donor gets paid. Everybody but the donor. The transplant surgeon gets paid, the transplant coordinator gets paid, the organ or tissue recipient is paid handsomely in kind. The only person upon whom altruism is imposed in the whole charade is the donor. That seems to me a mockery of a principle of altruism. And given that it is a mockery, we should look seriously into the justice of conniving in a system like that when the one person who risks and gives most receives little or nothing. We should note, and I'm skipping a lot here and I shall wind up now, but we should note that we don't think that the medical profession, for example, is any the less a caring profession because its members are paid handsomely, reasonably handsomely, I hope, for the doctors here, for what they do. So given the acuteness of the interim problem, given that thousands of people are dying worldwide for want of donor organs, given that we're going to have to wait quite a time for you to solve that interim rejection problem or for stem cells to come on stream, given, as I believe, that it is unethical to stand by and acquiesce in the continued loss of life, which is needless. Needless if we used all the cadaver organs that are available, and needless if we take seriously the idea of paying for live organ donations. Thank you.